I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
The San Francisco-based Bechtel Group, it was announced yesterday, is the victor in the contest for a $34.6 million contract to help rebuild Iraq, a contract which could reach a whopping $680 million over the next year and a half. That the Bechtel Group would be awarded the contract by the U.S. government shouldn't, on the face of it, stir all that much controversy. Bechtel's an immense, sophisticated construction firm of global reach, including extensive experience in Iraq. But the award is controversial. To explore why, we're joined now on the line from Washington, D.C., by Stephen Glane of the Boston Globe. Welcome, Steve.
Hello.
Stephen, the selection process itself has come under fire. What can you tell us about that?
The process has been done very much behind closed doors. It's been characterized as a secret tender, which the tendering agency in this case, the United States Agency for International Development, defends on the grounds that to have an open bidding process would take time, and that could hinder coalition efforts to stabilize Iraq politically.
Of course, the controversy tends to swirl around Bechtel's links to the Republican Party. Bechtel made $1.3 million in campaign contributions in the past few years, 59% of it to the Republican Party. What should we make of that, or are we making too much of that?
Well, I think it should be pointed out that it's not just Bechtel that apparently has these ties to the Republican Party. There's a subsidiary of Halliburton, which was issued a fairly lucrative contract to cap oil well fires that may have been left behind by forces loyal to Saddam Hussein. Having said that, I think political donations is a factor of life in American democracy, and it's hard to find a major company that has not spent a lot of time and money nurturing contacts with both parties.
But, of course, it does go a level deeper, does it not? Andrew Natsios is the administrator of USAID, the U.S. Agency for International Development, which awarded this contract. Before that, he oversaw the big dig here in Boston, the prime contractor for that, Bechtel.
That's correct. And I think it's these issues that a lot of congressmen, especially in the Democratic Party, would have liked to have ventilated as part of an open process. And I think because there are some seeming conflicts of interest, that has made this whole process quite controversial.
Now, speaking of an open process, the administration's making it quite clear that at least for the short term, firms from Europe, the United Nations will be excluded from the rebuilding process. What are the pitfalls of that?
If you believe basic economic theory, the more exclusive a bidding process, the odds are that the ultimate award will be more expensive by excluding foreign competition and just competition in general.
And on the question of lowering bids, the administration's set aside only $2 billion for the reconstruction so far, some concern that that may not last all that long. And another question, Steve, just to finish up. There's some speculation out there, some criticism out there, that the administration may be concentrating too much on rebuilding Iraq's infrastructure, roads and schools and sewers and water pipes and all that, at the expense of other basics that keep a country running, like civil servants, for example.
That's correct. And certainly that was the case in Afghanistan, where the not just the U.S. government, but other countries focused on the big-ticket projects at the expense of the less glamorous but no less important areas, like you say, civil servant salaries, training, these things that are vital to the whole process of nation building. There does seem to be a bias in favor of the big projects that are worth a lot of money.
Stephen Glane, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Stephen Glane, Washington-based correspondent for the Boston Globe, joined us from Washington, D.C.
Well, the Bechtel contract is, of course, good news for that U.S. company. But the latest economic figures aren't nearly as encouraging for most U.S. workers. The Labor Department reports the number of Americans filing for jobless benefits rose to the second highest level of the year last week as companies continue to hand out pink slips. We're joined on the line by Patrick Anderson. He's the principal founder of the Anderson Economic Group in Lansing, Michigan. Welcome, Patrick.
Hello.
So we saw the highest number of unemployed this year just last March 29th. So there wasn't a lot of respite from that before this new high. 30,000 more people filed last week, and the number climbed back up again, making it the ninth straight week of jobless claims above the 400,000 mark. Did you expect this latest number?
I wasn't surprised to see that initial unemployment claims have continued to be very high. The factor that's driving a lot of this, I believe, is the war in Iraq and the uncertainty that surrounded it. These initial claims were being filed right when we were in the teeth of that.
Well, how does that work? Companies are nervous and start laying off people. How does that impact?
Companies are clearly nervous. Consumers are nervous. There's a war going on. It doesn't take an economist to realize that people are going to be careful about making long-term decisions when there are people shooting at each other.
Well, what about now that we're, you know, not seeing people shooting at each other as much? There is a long rebuilding effort ahead. How do you think the economy will respond to that?
That's what I'm looking very closely at. 1 month from now, if we see initial unemployment claims that are anywhere near this level, then I will be extremely concerned that we'd be headed for a double-dip recession.
Well, Patrick, there are economists who say that even if the economy does improve in the next few months, the jobless rate might continue to creep up. Why is that?
Unemployment and employment tends to lag initial activity. So I wouldn't be surprised if we saw continued sluggishness. But if we come out of a very successful campaign in Iraq and we start to see rebuilding of that country, that removes an enormous amount of uncertainty to the national economy, to the world economy, as well as making people just feel a whole lot better.
Well, we've talked here on the program before about other factors that lead to unemployment, businesses leery of buying the big ticket items, and then consumers. I mean, they may be buying things, they may be spending, but I'm sure as you're feeling in your state, they're not buying things like cars.
Well, consumers are slow on cars right now, but I think the biggest story in the economy over the last year and a half since September 11th has been how strong the automobile industry has been. Given the slowdown in the economy, the auto industry is doing as well as could ever be hoped, and certainly better than expected.
Patrick, the numbers that we're seeing of the unemployed, is there something else going on there? Are people filing that might normally not have filed? Maybe they wait a few months. Is there something else going on with those unemployment numbers?
In some states, Robin, there have been changes in the unemployment system. For example, in Michigan, there was a change that allowed benefits to be higher. The rules of the game do affect how people play the game, and that does mean that in some states you're going to see a little bit of extra claims filing because the benefits have become a little bit richer.
I'm wondering, too, if in some cases people might say, oh, I'm not going to file because I'll get a job in a couple months, and then they don't.
You do see it when you break down the unemployment figures and you look at how long people have been out of work. I think there is more of that setting in that people are no longer believe they're going to find a job as quickly. But even with that being the case, you still see employment levels now that are much better than they were in the 1980s. So it's clear that the U.S. economy is fundamentally strong and it's much better than it was 10 or 15 years ago, even in a sluggish state.
Patrick, thank you.
Robin, good to talk to you.
Patrick Anderson is the principal founder of the Anderson Economic Group. He spoke to us from Lansing, Michigan.
Tens of thousands of Baghdad residents, Sunni and Shia Muslims alike, have been demonstrating today against the U.S. military presence in Iraq. Crowds were in front of the Abu Hanifa al-Numan Mosque chanting, "No to Saddam, no to USA," and Sunni and Shia are one. Meanwhile, electricity has been restored in Baghdad, at least intermittently, to parts of the city, and at least part of the Iraqi police force is back on the job. And there are other signs of a yearning for normalcy, if that's the word for it, normalcy amidst the destruction in Baghdad. Dick Gordon, host of NPR's Connection, is in Baghdad today. He visited Baghdad's School of Music and Ballet and spoke to Hisham Sharif, the director of Iraq's National Symphony Orchestra.
You know, all my memory in this school, I study here from 6 years till 18, and after I finish college, I come here teacher and director. All my memory is here now. I see only a shadow of good time I live in Iraq. I think what happened to my members of my symphony orchestra, because I don't know if they come back alive or no. Now I see only 10 players yesterday, but I don't know what happened to the another players. I don't think now in this time in my house or my school. Only I want peace and my friend and my symphony orchestra be good. This is what I feel now.
Hi, Dick.
Hi, Bill.
Dick, such a poignant moment there from the director of the Iraqi Symphony. Shadow of good times, he said, yearning for peace. Are these men angry about the devastation of their city right now, about the presence of U.S. troops? How are they feeling?
It really depends on who you speak to. There, I would say that if you were to take the American equivalent of a public opinion poll in the street, you'd find that the majority of people, the vast majority of people, are furious with the United States right now. But that has more to do with the fact that they haven't had the basic facilities for so long. You were quite right to point out that electricity is starting to be restored, but nobody's depending on it. It's flickering on and off in the sort of way that it would toast electrical appliances. I saw a garbage truck moving today. That was some kind of a remarkable sight in a city like this. But when you talk to the artists, when you talk to the musicians, I think probably the best word to describe their current feeling is numbness. They talk about peace. They talk about a return to normalcy. But so much of what they had has been destroyed that it's difficult for them to look ahead.
You visited the College of Fine Arts in Baghdad. What did you find there, Dick?
It was one of the most heartbreaking scenes you can imagine, Bill, because there at that college, they had really done a job on the instruments. They have regular piano recital rooms. They probably had a dozen pianos there. Most of them had been pushed down the hallway on the second floor and down the stairs. Those that survived that trip were hauled away. The wreckage of the other ones was simply left scattered at the front door. I met one former student who came there and actually plunked away at a piano on a song that he had and composed. And my translator was there, my producer here, Mark Allard, myself. We were all crying just listening to this man desperately try to make a piece of music out of something that was just so broken.
Slow, tentative rebirth in Baghdad. Dick Gordon, thank you very much for bringing us there.
Bill, a pleasure.
Dick Gordon, host of NPR's The Connection, spoke to us from Baghdad.
Just ahead, Arizona honors a fallen Native American soldier, and the president of the Navajo Nation explains what patriotism means to his people.
And later in the program, what did CNN know, and when did they report it?
There's more coming up, here and now.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
After the death of Army Private First Class Lori Piestua, the first woman and the first Native American to be killed in combat in Iraq, a debate grew in her home state over whether to change the name of Squaw Peak to Piestua Peak. But yesterday, in a 5-to-1 vote, Arizona's State Board on Geographic and Historic Names waived its 5-year waiting period and approved the name change. Lori Roberts, columnist for the Arizona Republic, has been following the story.
The issue of Squaw Peak has been a heated one here for years. There are many people, and many in the Native American community, who feel that the word is a slur on Native American women, while others steadfastly say that it is not, that it simply is a word, squaw, that means Native American women. There have been people who have tried in the past to change the word and have not been successful. Some Republicans in the legislature feel that Governor Napolitano has seized on the very tragic death of Private Lori Piestua to use as a political wedge to change this landmark from Squaw Peak to Piestua Peak. And it's become, in just a week, a very, very emotional issue. There is not anyone in the state of Arizona that does not have a strong opinion.
Lori Roberts, columnist for the Arizona Republic. Squaw Peak has been changed to Piestua Peak in honor of Army Private First Class Lori Piestua.
Home to us is the ground between the four sacred mountains. Mount Hesperus, Mount Taylor, San Francisco Peaks, and La Plata. That was long ago. Much of that has been taken from us by the U.S. cavalry, the U.S. government. At one time we were herded into one camp, so to speak, and then herded across the land to Bosque Redondo, I think is what they call it, Fort Sumner. Held prisoners there for 4 years. And the forebearers, our forebearers, pleaded, I guess, and somehow struck an agreement, a treaty, whereby we were set free to come back onto Navajo land, what we regard as Navajo land, but much smaller.
The original Americans, Native Americans, have long served in the American Armed Services in percentages far exceeding their numbers in the population. And Native Americans have long died in America's wars. Lori Piestua was a member of the relatively small Hopi tribe, but the nearby Navajo reservation is the largest in the country and is also well represented in the U.S. military. Producer Jordana Gustafson visited Window Rock, Arizona, headquarters of the Navajo Nation, and spoke with Navajo President Joe Shirley, Jr.
When I was driving here, mm-hmm. I saw a cemetery that I passed on the road, and mm-hmm. every grave site was decorated with an American flag. Mm-hmm. And I passed an elementary school, and they had, I think, a water tank and a huge painted sign, mm-hmm. God Bless America. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of Americans outside of the area would have a hard time understanding the patriotism of a group of people that has been so historically mm-hmm. repressed and some would say forgotten. Mm-hmm. Can you explain that?
Navajo people, along with other Native American nations out there, have always been very patriotic. They've always stood side by side with the U.S. soldiers to combat, make war against the foreign element. I think it's partly because they're not only defending the U.S. government and the United States as a country, but in the case of Navajo people, we're also defending our way of life, our sacred dwelling place between the four sacred mountains. That's actually what we're protecting. So that's why I think, part of the reason why I believe Navajo people are very patriotic. They want to be in there helping to defend not only the U.S. government, the U.S. land, the U.S. country, but also the motherland, Navajo land.
So you and your nation will continue to support the United States government and President Bush because you feel it will ultimately support your people and your land, even though there have been some concerns about the recent Supreme Court decision saying the United States isn't liable for mismanagement of the coal mining here, and even though there's some concerns about not taking into account Navajo needs in terms of the water from the Colorado River.
Those are what I would consider in-house issues. of course, families from time to time will have disagreements, and sometimes they'll fight, you know, over this or over that. The U.S. government, I consider a family. The Native nations will have disagreements with the Papa and the Mama, which would be the U.S. government, you know. But given the mechanism that is in place to resolve differences, to the best of our ability, we try to work to get at our differences, and hopefully the Mama and the Papa will hear to where, you know. But otherwise, when it comes to war, it's a different matter. We're talking about, in this case, a foreign element coming in to try to hurt the family. And that's where Native nations come in to support and stand with Mama and Papa, you know.
I read that you led a walk in support of the troops.
Oh, yes. I participated in a couple of walks, and then also consoling one of the Hopi families who had a daughter, Private First Class Lori Piestewa. But we don't stop there. We're out there supporting our troops. A lot of these soldiers who are Navajo are like all other soldiers are parents, you know, just papas and mamas. And I had one of my staff assistants bring together some medicine people to talk about offering up prayers on behalf of our soldiers, behalf of the motherland here, Navajo land, and, of course, the country. Navajo people are very prayerful people. It's just our way of life. So we're trying to come through just doing what we can and everything we can to support our soldiers in the armed forces. Yeah.
Producer Jordana Gustafson spoke with Navajo Nation President Joe Shirley Jr. in Window Rock, Arizona.
Next time on Here and Now, after weeks of watching the fighting in northern Iraq, correspondent Michael Goldfarb reflects on the military campaign and considers the chances for peace in the region now that Saddam has disappeared.
Plus, Tim Riley reviews new music by Johnny Cash's daughter, singer Roseanne Cash. That's next week.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, proudly supporting public radio and serving the community, on the web at MathWorks.com.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Coming up, CNN withholds information about years of torture under Saddam Hussein's regime, while an embedded reporter points out Iraqi soldiers to U.S. troops who then kill them. Our editorial roundtable asks, what is journalistic responsibility?
And we review director Neil Jordan's latest caper, a heist film starring Nick Nolte.
Name the best thief that ever lived.
Bob?
No. Pablo Picasso. Cat stole from everybody. Rubens, Delacroix, Cezanne, Van Gogh, Matisse. Never got caught.
These stories, coming up here and now. I'm Marianne Nichols. Abu Dhabi Television is airing a video of someone who appears to be Saddam Hussein, surrounded by throngs of supporters in the streets of Baghdad. The network claims it was recorded April 9th as U.S. forces were moving into the city. Some believe the man on the video is one of Saddam's doubles. Seven former prisoners of war, American prisoners of war, are going home to the U.S. tomorrow. They've been receiving treatment for injuries at the Landstuhl Military Hospital in Germany, along with more than 250 others who were wounded in Iraq. The seven former POWs made a brief public appearance today. Pilot David Williams spoke for the group.
On behalf of my fellow soldiers, I'd like to take a brief moment to let everyone know that we're receiving outstanding medical care. And I'd like to thank all of my fellow Americans. We all would like to thank our Americans for the tremendous support we've been getting. And we're looking forward to coming home as soon as we possibly can.
At least five of the freed prisoners were comrades of former POW Jessica Lynch. They're part of the Army's 507th Maintenance Support Company based at Fort Bliss, Texas. At least six more SARS deaths have been reported in Asia, where the deadly respiratory illness has infected some 3,000 people. After recent criticism that the country may have held back information, China is ordering health officials not to conceal any cases. Meantime, Hong Kong officials say they may start using infrared scanning devices to screen people for fever if they cross the border from the southern province where the illness is believed to have originated. More layoffs for the airline industry. Boeing Aircraft is cutting jobs at its factories, while struggling U.S. Airways is eliminating some 900 flight attendant jobs. Boeing is expected to issue layoff notices to more than 1,000 people, mostly in the Puget Sound area, where the firm has two commercial jet factories. U.S. Airways has announced plans to reduce its flight schedule, as well as the layoff of 3% of its workforce. Pilots of commercial airliners may soon be carrying handguns in the cockpit. Tomorrow, the first group of pilots finish their firearms training at a federal training center in Georgia. With the recent fighting between Israelis and Palestinians, the Good Friday and Passover traditions are subdued this year. Crowds of Christian pilgrims who have come to retrace the steps of Christ are much smaller. Israel has closed off the West Bank and the Gaza Strip over fears of terror attacks during the Passover holiday.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Two journalists are under fire this week for their work in Iraq, one for not telling what he knew, another for telling. CNN chief news executive Eason Jordan admitted last week that he knew, among other things, that a CNN Iraqi cameraman was tortured in the mid-90s, that Saddam's son Uday planned to assassinate his own brothers-in-law, which he then did, and that other Iraqis were tortured, their teeth and fingernails pulled off. But Jordan says he kept it all quiet to save the lives of his sources. On the other hand, Boston Herald embedded reporter Jules Crittenden says that while under Iraqi fire, he pointed out Iraqi soldiers to U.S. troops who then shot them dead. Saved lives or loss of credibility? Life, death, and journalistic decisions in wartime. That's the topic we're putting before our editorial roundtable today. Joining us on the line are Pat Walker, editor of the Bucks County Courier-Times in Levittown, Pennsylvania. Hi, Pat.
Hi, Robin.
And Bill Nemitz, columnist for the Portland Press Herald in Portland, Maine. Hello, Bill.
Hi, Robin.
Bill, let's start with you and to Eason Jordan and CNN first. He's caused firestorms, as you know. Critics say he was compromising on the news for the, 12, 13 years that CNN had the bureau in Baghdad. He was compromising to keep his much-vaunted bureau open. But Jordan says that CNN had more reporters kicked out of Baghdad than anyone for critical reporting. So what do you think?
For starters, I'm flabbergasted at just how much material they withheld. And I think that at some point you have to make the decision as to whether it's worth it to stick around, because I think what his rationale was that their primary goal was to stay in Baghdad and at the same time, of course, not jeopardize the lives of their employees and sources. But at some point, the critical mass of material that you're withholding or sitting on, I think, reaches the point where it undermines your overall credibility. And we are now left, on the one hand, understanding that Ethan Jordan didn't want to get anyone killed. But on the other hand, you can't help but look around the world right now and wonder what else isn't CNN telling us.
Well, there's that. And, Pat, others have said how many were killed by Saddam Hussein because people didn't know about the torturous regime. Pat, your thoughts?
I agree. I don't think you get it both ways. I'm sure the question's out there, how much is about ratings for CNN and how much is about the truth? You demand the truth of those you cover, and you have to hold yourself to that same standard.
Let me ask both of you, though. Syndicated columnist Ellen Goodman asked yesterday whether this whole war wasn't edited. You know, we didn't see any blood or guts. These are my words. It was a war sort of fought on innuendo. Bill?
Well, you know, Robin, we spoke on this program just at the beginning of the war about, you know, what is it going to be like and what are we going to see? And I have to tell you, my fears as to what we were going to see were never realized, because there wasn't as much, I don't know, you know, live action, if you will, as I thought. And as a result, there weren't a lot of those gut-wrenching decisions that had to be made as to whether or not something should have gotten out. I think it was very managed. And I think Pat is 100% correct when you say you can't have this discussion regarding CNN without factoring in what was really a very vigorous ratings war on this side of the ocean.
Well, remember, the CNN decision by Jordan was over the past 12 years. I mean, it wasn't about this war in particular, but the Washington Post editorial is saying that CNN's not reporting what they knew the last 5, 6, 7 years is a reason so many people around the world, including Arabs, don't know about these things.
Well, it's their primary source of information. And I would say, though, that all the decisions that they made over that period of time were with an eye toward being there when all hell broke loose.
And, I agree.
It was crucial to them that they not get kicked out. I mean, look at what happened when they did. I mean, it was a real crisis for them in the middle of the war.
What would you have done, Pat, if you were bureau chief?
Well, I'm always in favor of the truth. And again, it's a tough decision, but I think if we aim towards the truth, that's the best course.
Bill, close the bureau, bring everybody home, as many people home as you can, and report what you knew.
I think at some point you have to decide whether or not it's worth it. And right now, CNN is faced with the rather daunting prospect of having to rehab their reputation.
Well, let's move on to Boston Herald embedded reporter Jules Crittenden. He's the fellow who was rolling in on a tank into Baghdad and pointed out to the soldiers on the tank where some Iraqis were, and they turned around and shot and killed them. Bill, your thoughts?
Well, I think he puts it quite well when he says, quote, "It was here that I went over to the dark side." And, you know, it's a question that bedeviled a lot of us because this war was looming, was what happens when a journalist finds him or herself in harm's way? You know, at what point do you stop being the journalist and just start trying to be the survivor? As I read his account of this, I'm not sure that he personally reached that threshold of being threatened. There was fire going on, and he spotted these soldiers, and I won't use the word, he didn't use the word that he used to describe them, but he made it clear to the soldiers with him. And here again, I just almost said his comrades, which is what it sounds like. There they are, shoot them, and they did. As I read this, I'm not satisfied that he felt like I need to do this to save my life.
Well, Bill, he anticipated you, because as he also wrote in the article, "I'm sure there are some people who will question my ethics, my objectivity. I'll keep the argument short. Screw them. They weren't there." My apologies to parents who might be listening with kids. And he says, "You're welcome to join him next time if you care to test your professionalism."
Well, good point. And, you know, it's very easy to be critical over here while he was rolling through the streets of Baghdad. But I think this does point to what was, in many people's minds, the kind of squirmy side of this whole embedded journalist program. And that is, it took about a day before the journalists were almost universally referring to the soldiers they were traveling with as "we." And I think that spoke volumes.
I agree completely. It's been my dilemma over the embedding from the beginning. It's a way to see firsthand what happens, but I just felt that neutrality in stories was going to be sacrificed when you had to be in such close quarters and you started to become one of the soldiers. And I guess my devil's advocate side would say, is it humanly possible to remain neutral when you're in mortal danger? But it doesn't sound like in this column that he was in mortal danger.
It sounds as if the line for both of you is, yeah, if somebody's about to fire at you, you yell, hey, he's about to fire at me. But otherwise, you're there to take notes.
Yeah, and at some point, it's legitimate to stop taking notes and duck.
Well, we'll leave that at that. And by the way, we'll have a lot of reading material for our listeners online. You can go to our website and read some of the things we've been talking about. Bill, you have a story to take us into the weekend?
Well, up in northern Maine, a little bit of New Brunswick, Canada, jogs into this country. There's a couple that's been living up there for quite a while on a farm. And the only way to get to their property from other parts of New Brunswick is by passing through the United States. Their mailman, who is the Canadian postal mailman, was just told he could no longer deliver mail to them because he was illegally passing through this country. So they were, in effect, cut off from the rest of their country and were about to literally sell the farm when this week, finally, our Department of Homeland Security relented and said that they did not consider the mailman a sufficient security threat to bar him from delivering the mail.
Oh, so
the farm is safe.
Thank goodness. What will the Easter Bunny do to cross over?
I guess.
Want to thank you both.
Thanks, Robin.
Thanks.
Bill Nemitz, columnist for the Portland Press Herald in Portland, Maine. Pat Walker, editor of the Bucks County Courier-Times in Levittown, Pennsylvania.
By the way, to get to our website, to read some of the articles Robin was just discussing, our website is reached at here-now.org. Still to come, Neil Jordan directs Nick Nolte in a remake of the French noir classic. We review The Good Thief.
You're listening to Here and Now.
And now, a couple of observations and something of a confession as this week ends. The majority of the fighting in Iraq seemed to be ending. That statue of Saddam in downtown Baghdad's been toppled for a while now, and then this week, on the front page of the New York Times, that picture of U.S. commanders in the Abu Ghraib presidential palace in Baghdad, seated with their hands folded almost primly before them at an ornate conference table where Saddam Hussein used to hold court. And so, many now are looking back. Some are saying about the war in Iraq, hey, I got it right. I supported military force, and military force worked. And then there are others, to the left of those who say they got it right, who say, we'll see who wins the peace. These are the members of the steadfast anti-war camp, sticking to their guns, though that may be a poor choice of words. My confession is that, as a journalist, I'm not supposed to lean in any one direction on the stories I cover. But throughout the build-up to this war, and during the war itself, I confess I did lean. In fact, and here's the tricky part, on the question of the rightness or wrongness of using military force in Iraq, there have been very few positions that I have not, at one time or another, personally, even passionately, staked out. I have been on the right, and I have been on the left, and I have been several places in between. I've had the courage of my convictions, only not necessarily the same conviction from late morning to early evening of the same day. I have been ambivalent, to use the college-educated word for my condition. You could also just say confused. Now, for a journalist, this may not be all bad. We're supposed to be able to see all sides. And I have been open to all points of view, ready, in fact, to consider my latest position all wet at the drop of someone else's insight. I remember a report a few months ago about an Iraqi man living impoverished and alone in Jordan. He'd been a renowned ballet dancer in Baghdad. Until, for reasons never clear to him, he said, he'd been arrested and then brutally tortured by Saddam Hussein's police, and his beloved wife had been killed. I thought then the only moral position was force to depose the Iraqi regime. But now there are other searing stories and other images, as we knew all along there would be. An Iraqi boy around the age of my own son, without limbs, his whole family killed because of a U.S. bomb. Was that right? I wish I could have been more clear on this war. There's comfort in moral clarity, and I haven't had it. Have you? For me, it seems wrong and right shade into each other, instead of the bright moral palette of some. For me, maybe for you, gray. I wish the world and this war was black and white. I envy those for whom it is.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Although it wasn't his first film, Irish writer-director Neil Jordan really burst into the spotlight a decade ago with his critical darling, The Crying Game. It was nominated for 6 Academy Awards and topped reviewers' must-see lists for 1992. Jordan has directed 7 films since then. The latest is called The Good Thief. It's a remake of the 1955 French classic Bob Le Flambeur, directed by a master of slick crime films, Jean-Pierre Melville. Jordan's updated version takes place in the French Riviera and stars Nick Nolte as Bob Montanet, an aging hustler with a heroin habit. A local detective warns him early in the film to stay out of trouble.
You try a new scam, Bob. It won't be me. The whole system will flatten you.
I've retired. I'm a junkie gambler now. Big loser, that's all. Name the best thief that ever lived.
Bob?
No. Pablo Picasso. Cat stole from everybody. Rubens, Delacroix, Cezanne, Van Gogh, Matisse. Never got caught. Met him once.
I'm impressed.
A bullfight. I bet on the bull, he bet on the matador. Matador got 26 stitches. I got a painting. Still have it.
Then you're flush.
No. Broke. That never sells. Portrait of Jacques Lee.
Picasso, Rubens, and Cezanne figure prominently in The Good Thief, and Here and Now's film reviewers, Renee Graham and Eric Schaefer, are in the studio to talk about Neil Jordan's latest caper. Thanks for coming in.
Hi, Bill.
Hey, Bill.
So, Eric, it's a crime movie. Describe the heist.
Well, this film starts out with Bob really having hit rock bottom. He is as low as you can get, living there in the south of France. But he's approached by one of his friends, Raoul, who has an idea about knocking over a casino. But that's really just sort of a front, that particular part of the plan, for stealing the real booty, which is a group of priceless paintings.
The originals are in there.
Why are they in there?
It's a Japanese thing. Protect your investment. Painting in the vault. Perfect copy on the wall.
And we crack the vault.
Yes.
Yeah.
And you know the beautiful thing?
What's the beautiful thing?
They can't disclose the robbery because if they did, the joint closes. Who'd come to see a copy of a Van Gogh?
Somebody just walked over my grave and I'm going through a withdrawal.
Maybe you're excited.
Who tipped you off?
A friend of mine.
Leaving the best to last?
Vladimir. He installed the security system.
So, Renee, Nick Nolte as an aging junkie gambler. Seems like decent casting there, maybe perfect casting.
He was born to play this role. No one else could have done this. That wrecked voice, that ruined face. There's just nothing as heartbreaking and glorious as the ravaged beauty of a movie star. And you've got this character who you have the feeling was once sort of young and dashing and smart, all the things that Nick Nolte once was. And now he's sort of, you know, at the end of his rope, he's sort of falling apart. He's a good man, but he does the wrong things. And it's like he's trying to figure out how to do the wrong thing the right way for one last time. And it's a brave performance because everyone knows Nick Nolte's history, his own problems with addiction. And he brings all that to the character, and it just makes the character really the most compelling one in the film.
You okay?
No, I'm not okay. I'm out of dope and I'm out of luck and I'm tempted. And I want to die in an old folks home, not in a jail.
Well, then forget about it.
We'll need money, a lot of it. How do you plan to get it?
Take out a loan, Prédillionnet. We'll get the money, but what we need is a plan.
Don't you have one?
That's your specialty.
You know what my plan is?
Hey, you got one already.
No more gambling. No more dope. Till we pull this off.
So, Bob, you're in.
Of course I'm in.
He's always brought a sense of humanity to roles, often tough guys, still managing to find a certain poignancy in them sometimes.
Absolutely, and that's something that comes out in this role as Bob. He's very dignified. You know, even when he's handcuffed to a bed and going through detox from a heroin addiction, there's still this dignity about it. He never condescends to this character at all. It's really, I like the performance a lot.
You called it the ravaged beauty of a movie star. Not bad. Eric, I know you've seen the original, Bob Le Flambeur.
Yeah, it's been quite a while since I've seen the original. It made sort of a comeback about 8-10 years ago, played the repertory circuit. It's a very different movie from this one. Melville's film is very slick. It's sort of distanced in a lot of ways. And you know, what you would sort of expect from a film made in Paris in the mid-50s, very smoky and black and white and so on. This movie is a lot grittier in most respects, with the color photography, and you know, this south of France that we're seeing in The Good Thief is not going to be in any tourist brochures. It is an ugly, unpleasant place.
And it's not all Nick Nolte, is it? It's a very multicultural cast.
Right. Mm-hmm. We've got a very interesting cast. The guy who plays his pal, Raoul, who sort of proposes this, Gérard Darmon, who's a face that I think a lot of people will be familiar with. You've got his nemesis, Roger, the cop, played by a guy named Cheki Karyu. And then the woman who plays the young girl who comes into his life, the sort of prostitute figure, is played by, let me see if I can pronounce her name here, it's Nutse Kuyanza. I believe she is Bosnian. And she's really quite compelling, too. The only real problem is all of these secondary characters really get short shrift next to Bob. They're not as well developed as we might really like to see.
Hey, you!
Where are you going with that suitcase? You had enough?
The owner of my hotel has ridiculous principles. She always wants paying.
People you owe money to have always got ridiculous principles. What happened to the money I gave you?
Paid my debts.
What debts?
I owe Remy.
Oh, I'm sure you do. I won't ask what for.
He set me up here. Said I could pay him back weekly.
Does he charge interest?
What's that?
Never mind. All your worldly belongings in there?
Yes.
Where do you sleep tonight?
Somewhere.
You want to come to my place?
Yes.
Don't worry. You got a home. Get in.
Renee, what do you think Neil Jordan was up to with this film? And you talked about a great performance by Nick Nolte, but how does the film succeed or fail?
The film has this loose, jazzy energy to it, which I think it manages to mostly sustain. The only problem is, again, as Eric mentioned, the other characters aren't as well-developed as Bob, so there's sort of these sort of shadow characters who sort of come in and out, but it's Bob's show.
One of the biggest problems, I think, with this film is that the whole aspect of the heist, which of course is going to be central to any heist movie, is not that well handled. Mm-hmm. It is sort of an afterthought. And so that winds up being kind of a hole in the film as well.
I think he's more interested in Bob than the heist itself.
Right.
And that's what really shows.
And in atmosphere. The first, you know, 20 or 30 minutes of this film are extremely atmospheric. You know, you get a real sense of place. You can almost smell, you know, the streets and the rooms and the cheap wine and so on. But then, you know, things do begin to drift as we move more toward this kind of typical heist plot.
This multicultural flair to this movie? Is it kind of a relief from the Hollywood all-American cast? Do you like that? Sometimes those movies seem to have almost an amateurish tinge to them.
Well, I think it works here because you almost don't notice it until after the film. You're not looking and going, hey, it's not a bunch of white people all in this movie.
But the one thing that you do notice is the accents between Nolte's gravelly growl and all of these accents. I mean, half the dialogue is just incomprehensible.
So, Eric, your verdict?
My verdict is it's a good film. It has certain aspects, but I think there are better heist films out there if you're in the mood for something along those lines.
There are better heist films. Eric's right about that, and there have been a lot of comparisons with Ocean's 11, and I think this is a better film than Ocean's 11, both versions. I recommend the film because of Nolte's performance, especially coming off of his arrest last year and the world's worst mugshot. There's really something to the fact that he would do this role. And Neil Jordan's made a big point of saying, well, I didn't know how closely this character's paralleled, you know, Nick's life. But he has to know because it's such a perfect bit of casting.
I want to thank you both, as always, for coming in.
Thanks, Bill.
Thank you.
Here and Now's film reviewers are Eric Schaefer and Renee Graham. Eric's a film historian who teaches at Emerson College in Boston, and Renee Graham is pop culture correspondent for the Boston Globe.
The ponies run, the girls are young, the odds are there to be. You win a while, and then it's done. Your little winning streak.
Here Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
Our production team includes Andrea Shea, Lynn Menegon, April Peavy, Emiko Tamagawa, Alan Cockle, Karen Miller-Medson, and Stefano Katsonis. Our managing editor is Kathleen McKenna, and our editor is Mitch Wertlieb. Special thanks this week to Jordana Gustafson.
Vince Fairchild is our engineer. He's assisted by Andy Farnsworth. Our web producer is Zach Christo, and our interns are Lindsay Kudel, Marisa Francini, and Meheleka Somnani. The senior producer of Here and Now is Mark Navin.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
And stay tuned, please, to your public radio station for the latest developments.
Have a great weekend, and join us again Here and Now.
You lose your grip.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software. Information on the web at MathWorks.com. At MathWorks.com.